This recording was made November the 8th, 2008, in the Teachers Club in Dublin, Ireland. It's a recording from the third session of the Bloom Conference. Bloom defines itself as a movement of people in Ireland taking action together for global justice. This session was grassroots mobilisation in Ireland, opportunities and challenges.
Bringing it all back home session, so it's the session on grassroots mobilisation in Ireland. How do we get ordinary people in Ireland involved in solidarity work, involved in global justice issues in Ireland? How do we connect those? What are the challenges? What are the opportunities? All of this. We've got four speakers and we are going to finish this on time. We will take the hour and no more than that, so it will be Stalinistically chaired. We've got, firstly, Claire O'Grady-Walsh on the far left here, who was on the 1st Irish Coffee Brigade to Nicaragua, has been with Greenpeace Ireland, coordinates AFRI's development education work, and is a board member of Irish Seed Savers, which I gather she wants to make a plug for at a later point. So, Claire. Jean Summers, who's been involved in many a campaign over the years, particularly most recently in the Debt and Development Coalition, and now she's working in the community and voluntary sector. Gregor Kerr, who's in Worker Solidarity and lots of different community and trade union campaigns, and wants me to make a plug for the Justice for Terence Wheelock campaign. And Eric Yao, currently of the Africa Centre, who's been campaigning on human rights issues in Poland and the Gambia, again, for a very long time. So, another all-star cast. And the format's going to be like one of those silly TV shows. So we've got two questions to our entire panel, and we'll give the panel each 3 minutes to respond to each of these questions. After they've dealt with the two questions, we'll throw it open to the floor, and then we'll come back to them for a round of summaries. And believe it or not, that's actually all we have time for in an hour, according to all the emails we've been swapping previously. So, ladies and gentlemen, fingers on the buzzer, coffee at the ready. The first question we've been asked to talk about is, what do you think are the challenges for grassroots mobilisation in Ireland, and if there are opportunities too? And we've asked people particularly not to talk in the abstract, but to root what they're saying in their own political work. So I'll hand it over to Claire.
Is this working? Yeah. A cordial good afternoon, and thank you to the organisers for organising this today. It's a very important discussion and bringing the global and the local together, hopefully. But I feel a resistance rising in the gula here with our Stalinist chairman, but I have to speak a little bit longer than 3 minutes, but anyway, I'll try and keep it brief. But for me, the challenges to the grassroots mobilisation in Ireland at the moment, I feel, are the biggest challenges to make links between the different campaigns that we are organising and struggling with within the country itself first, that to link all the NIMBYs, if you like, together, then you have a serious national movement. So NIMBY being not in my backyard, a lot of the people who've been organising campaigns against the toxic chemical industry, for example, the nuclear industry 30 years ago, there's a lot of those people still around. There's the campaigns against incinerators, there's now the campaign against Shell and Eris. These are all linked, you know, together, but the people don't know one another necessarily, and those links aren't always made. And they're inextricably linked, of course, to fair trade, to debt cancellation, because in a lot of these cases we're looking at the same transnational corporations and the same system. So I think that's one of the big things, to make links between different campaigns, to not be constantly reinventing the wheel. I've seen so many communities literally going back and all of a sudden all having to be educated about planning and, you know, the various different things all over again. I think one of the biggest challenges is to get the best information possible. I think we're getting much, much better at doing that. But if you have the best information, then you have the best chance of winning your campaign. And if you are connected to a global campaign, then you have the best information available. I have great, I suppose, privilege of working with Greenpeace International for 7 years, and I saw the upsides and the downsides of that. But one of them was that the information was always absolutely top brass, that you absolutely could stand over it, and that you always did were able to refer to other experts. So they're some of the major challenges. I think just one other thing is that I think we have to know where the power really lies and where we are giving our power away. And I mean that specifically that... I mean, I hope I get a chance to talk about it a little bit more later, but say, for example, in relation to food and energy security, I think of things very elementary at this stage, having gone into great abstracts and academia and everything like that over all the years, but actually, the food we eat, and I thought very appropriate for the week that's in it, I brought everyone a black knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, a black knight seed. It's a runner bean, so that everybody can plant their own seed. But the issue about our food security is literally down to who owns the seeds. And this is happening globally and locally at the moment. IrishSeedSavers.ie is the organisation in Ireland. Just over the last 15 years, we've been saving all of the national heritage varieties of Irish seed that are not commercially available. We've lost 90% of our biodiversity on the planet in the last 100 years. In 2004, Paul Bremer, the US proconsul in Iraq, passed 100 orders before they ceded power back to the Iraqi government, or the so-called Iraqi government. And Order 81 was to patent seeds in Iraq. This is the cradle of civilization where farming began. So I've been doing work on seed research on the issues of literally from where Ayad is from in Palestine through the Fertile Crescent in Iraq, the issue of seed colonization, right to our own country, where Irish seed savers have saved like these heritage varieties. And so I tried in about 4 different supermarkets recently to get garlic, which grows naturally in our country, and I couldn't get one that wasn't from China. And seed savers are growing them, and you can grow garlic in a pot, even if you don't only have a flat, you can grow it in a pot in your back garden. So I actually think issues of food security are absolutely things that we can do something about today. And issues of energy security, how you got here today, did you come by bike or public transport or whatever, these are things that are actually going to change the world. You know, they are very, very simple, but we are standing on the backs of poor people who are being oppressed if we do not make these changes. And I that's all I'm going to say right now, because there's other things that I'd like to say, but I think these are the very practical challenges that the very hopeful thing is we can do something about.
Hello everyone, I just wanted to say that I think the all-star cast is out there in front of me. So, the point I was going to focus on in terms of what are the challenges is that it's a long haul, it's not a quick fix. And I remember some years ago hearing a dead campaigner from the Philippines talking about, you know, what we needed to achieve and how we needed to change the world. And she made this point, she said, we may not all see this in our lifetimes. And I thought that we need some stepping stones on the way, some victories on the way. And I thought that was a really important point. Because what happens is people expect quick fixes, and when they don't, they get really disappointed. I don't know how many times I've heard people say 100,000 of us walked against the war in Ireland and that didn't change government policy. I think we have to get away from this kind of stimulus response, or you do this and you get this reaction. I think part of the problem is that there's a kind of business model out there that has actually ended up occupying our minds, in the sense that whatever the dominant economic system, and go back to what Heather was saying this morning actually about the ideas that lie behind the economic system, and I think that, you know, the business model is about results, quick fixes, inputs, outputs. And I found that in the debt movement sometimes, that people would get really either frustrated or they'd get really disappointed, and they'd say, but why hasn't the debt been cancelled? And sometimes, very rarely actually, people would even nearly shoot the messenger and say, but how long has debt and development been going, you know? And I'm just thinking back to my own earliest activism was in the women's liberation movement in Britain, where I lived at the time. And what I found was that the very act of joining the women's liberation movement actually liberated me, in the sense of it liberated my spirit. There was no change in the in patriarchy, but I felt different through having made common cause and having the problems be named in the public arena and be joining collaboratively. So moving on then to think... other opportunities. I think that the opportunities I've built around discontent, and I'm just thinking of all the discontent in Ireland at the moment, all the no's, no to Lisbon, no to all the various elements of the budget. I think there's a new no to patriarchy developing. There was a feminist meeting last week to revive the feminist movement, and I'm sure there's lots of other ones as well. But the one I haven't seen is really no to the bank bailout, and I think we were the first people today to march on the streets to actually even challenge or question that. And I think part of the problem there could be that there was no mechanism for us to mobilise against the banks. And when I was thinking about this session today, I was thinking, gosh, if only we had Bloom well established, and we had, do you remember the Make Poverty History demonstration about 2005, and there's 20,000 people on the streets of Dublin. I thought if we had Bloom, 20,000 people, we could have had a human chain from the Department of Finance down to the Central Bank, round there and then down and circle the Financial Services Centre. I made a strong statement that this isn't, you know, the biggest financial crisis since 1929. There have been terrible crises in between, like the debt issue. And I think it's important to make those, for us to make those kind of links. I was at a... and I think that what we need to do is be distilling out a bigger no from under all these no's. We'll have to decide how we frame it, but it's a kind of no to neoliberalism. I think one of the problems there is that we're much better at, generally, you know, people may challenge this, at organising, running campaigns, making demands of governments, of international bodies, than we are at tackling, say, the financial markets. I mean, how do you tackle the international financial markets? And some years ago, I was at an international conference on debt, and this bloke, who did a lot of work on the IMF and civil society, was present at that, and he challenged us. He said, look, you're putting all your efforts into campaigning on the IMF. You really should be looking at the international financial markets, because that's where a lot of the power is. And I remember personally a lot of other people thinking, like, get off the stage, like, you know, it's hard enough to take on the IMF without taking on financial markets. But I think now, if we have a joined up movement, we're in a better position to actually do that. So, and just to say, in terms of making the links, I was at a seminar last week about community, it's a very local issue, about community involvement in local planning. And, you know, we all know about the PP, private-public partnerships collapsing here in Dublin around housing. And the person presenting the case, and he was looking very much at local communities in Dublin, he then stepped back and he said, made links between what's happening now with the PPs collapsing, etc., and the third world debt crisis from the 1980s. And I was absolutely thrilled to hear that. So I think it's about bringing the no's together.
I think one of the major challenges, one of the major challenges, there's plenty of them, but one of the major challenges to grassroots mobilisation at the moment is the sort of clientelist and consumerist nature of approach to politics that a lot of people have. Outside of a relatively small group of activists, I mean, the great thing about meetings like this is it brings together people from different campaigns and different groups. But I think people who are used to going to political meetings and political actions and stuff like that, you get fed up, as much nice and all of the people you meet on them might be, you get fed up just seeing just the same faces all the time. And one of the challenges that I think we have is that a lot of people tend to approach politics from a sort of consumerist and clientelist sort of base. Quite often, I would have lost count in the number of times as a trade union activist where fellow workers would have said to me, what's the union doing about it? And the answer has got to be, well, actually, you're part of the union. If you want the union to do something about it, you've got to get stuck in, go to union meetings, try and have policy change, try and have policy implemented, etc. I remember a number of years ago, at the start of building the campaign against the bin tax in Dublin, speaking at a public meeting in one of the Dublin suburbs on the issue, and quite a packed meeting, about 60 or 70 people. It was an area in which I didn't live, so I went along to the meeting and I explained the issues and said, right, this is a campaign that has to be built in each community, and there has to be a local campaign in each community, so we need some volunteers from this meeting to help the process of starting to build a campaign in this area and link with other areas as well. And a number of people volunteered from the meeting, but it sort of didn't take off, and we had a couple of meetings with a couple of volunteers, but for various different reasons it filtered out. So we went back again a number of months later, about maybe 6 months later, held another public meeting in the same area. Again, a very, very well attended meeting, and again the same points we made about the unjustness of the tax and the need to organise against it and all the rest. And all was going well until some woman down in the hall put up her hand and says, "That's all well and good," she said, "but you were here 6 months ago saying that, what have you done since?" So, and the challenge that obviously was to turn it back and say, well, what have you done? You know, politics doesn't happen outside of what you get involved in doing. That is really, that you need to get involved and stuck in. And I think that challenge is a difficult one, that to break that sort of consumerist, clientelist approach to it. And how to do it, I think, is that we need to give people a sense of their own power. We actually need to give people a sense that getting involved in things does make a difference. And so if you take, in the very, very recent examples, after the budget of the over-70s coming out and forcing the government climb down on the issue of the medical cards, that's very significant from a couple of reasons. And one of them is that for the first time in quite a long time, it's possible to point to a group of people that getting out actually made a huge difference and an immediate difference. And I agree with what was said there a minute ago, that it's not always that easy. It doesn't always happen that you get an immediate result like that. But you do need to have some sense, that sense of power, that sense of that getting involved makes a difference. Why give up your Saturday afternoon? Why spend all day sitting at a meeting like this? You know, that you need to have some sense of power. And I think part of that is that the campaigns that we build need to be very open, very democratic, and very grassroots oriented, so that people feel a sense of ownership as well of the campaigns that they're getting involved in, and don't feel that they're just a cannon fodder that come along to meetings and get sent out then to sort of implement decisions that have already been made, but that people can feel that they have themselves an input and a valuable input to make. I would say that one of the reasons that I could talk about this all day, and I know we're going to have a minute, but one of the main reasons for that client that is sort of consumerist approach is the very fact of an electoral system where people have this idea that, you know, you go out every couple of years and you vote for whatever your favourite candidate is or the person who's closest to your politics, and they go off and sort it out. And that sort of, you know, if you want to get something fixed, you go to your local councillor. You know, so that the idea that we need to try and mobilise people to do stuff for themselves rather than depending on politicians to do it. The opportunity, the major opportunity, we have an opportunity now that we haven't had, I think, for a long, long time. Capitalism is in crisis. Now, if as an anarchist, when I would have been saying many years ago that capitalism is the problem, you get laughed at by most people. Now, Business and Finance magazine and the Financial Times are all saying capitalism is in crisis. There's an acceptance that the system doesn't work. There's an acceptance on all sorts of levels that the neoliberal phase of capitalism hasn't worked and it hasn't benefited the vast majority of people. So the opportunity is that the current system is being seen to have broken down and is seen to be in serious, serious trouble. And the challenge for us is, what can we propose to put in its place?
I think I'm going to also talk from the perspective of an African living in Ireland. The challenges I see are manifold, but I'll just pinpoint a few of them. The interconnectivity between the African community and the local Irish community. Okay, that's one area, because it looks like that connection is not strong. The issue of awareness, and also the differences in the needs of the African community vis-à-vis the Irish community, you realize that a lot of Africans who are living in Ireland come in three phases. You have maybe economic migrants who are here employed, and then you might have students, and you would have refugees or asylum seekers. Now, even in all these three classifications, you would realize that there is that element of fear when it comes to activism, you know, because you're not too sure what authorities are going to say about you or what they're going to do to you. One, if you're a student, what's your lecturer going to say? You know, I remember when I was in Poland, the Polish students, we went on strike. We went and we picketed and on some issues that were affecting the student body. And I can tell you for a fact, they pinpointed the black faces in the crowd. And I failed my exams twice. You know, I mean, not because I didn't know the stuff, but the guy just failed me. And I had to go and take the exam before a commission. And the commission was like, so how come you failed twice? I said, go ask the professor. You know, so those are elements that are there. For example, if you are an asylum seeker or a refugee here, the fear is, okay, if you go join in to do stuff, what are the repercussions for you? You know, so those are challenges that we're facing, and we irrespective of that, you know, there are opportunities to overcome, you know, some of these issues, because you realize that Ireland is a different country, you know, from the developing world. Here you can hold people to account, you know, if you get the right people behind you. So the issue here is how connected are we? You know, when we're having stuff and we send emails out, we send press releases out and stuff, how interested will our colleagues from the Irish community be in standing behind us to go forward on some of these issues? And also vis-a-vis, we also have to be interested in following up and teaming up, you know, when other issues are being brought to the forefront, and be seen to be also joining hands with our Irish colleagues. Now, the opportunities I see here is that if you look at Africa, you look at Palestine, you look at South America. When you go and you are an activist, a grassroots activist, you are aware that it's either you get injured or you die. It's as simple as that. You go out there, you're doing stuff, you either get injured or you die. Then for us, the big thing here is that in Ireland, at least you won't die. Yeah, you are not going to die. I mean, the guard might come and whack you in the face or something, but you still, a few bruises is fine, but you will not die, because nobody is going to come with an AK-47 and stand there and just fire into the crowd. You know, those kind of things are there. And so we believe that we can take advantage of these opportunities. In addition, the easy access to the internet is a big opportunity here for us. And we see that, and that's one of the key advantages we from the Africa Center see in being actively involved in the Bloom, you know, because we see the openness of the World Wide Web, and we can use that as a means to get our issues across as well. Thank you.
Speakers are doing great for discipline and revolutionary timekeeping.
Right.
So, good. We're going to move straight on to the second question, and then we'll throw it open. So, the second question, which we'll take in the same format, is what does movement building mean to you? And do you think there is a particular value on taking a movement building approach to global justice work?
Yes, and I realised that I didn't actually finish the end of my last thing, which was about the opportunities, but I'm going to link it into this one. Because the part of what movement building means to me and some of the opportunities are quite similar. Movement building means to me that we actually learn from past experience. And in the week that's in it, and I think Benedicta spoke about it eloquently earlier, that with the election of Barack Obama, on the back of a grassroots mobilisation effort to get out a vote, and particularly to enfranchise people who had never voted before. I think that has to be a marker. I know a lot of friends of mine from my group these days, activists who went volunteering into the hardest states in the US in the last number of months, into Pennsylvania places, to get the vote out, and for places that actually won the election for Barack Obama. I do think there's one big lesson that I think that we could learn from it here. And it's directly linked to a lot of the campaigns that I've been involved in around the country over the last kind of 20 years in Ireland as well. And that is that Barack Obama and the campaign, in the Democratic campaign, did very well in linking his present to the history of the whole movement over the last hundreds of years in the United States of America. So he placed himself in that story. And so you have everybody saying, like, this is Martin Luther King's dream come true. So it remains to be seen, as we've all been saying, what happens now. But of course, it is a moment for us to reflect on. And for me, I've been saying, and boring people for a number of years, saying that I still look back to the Land League in Ireland as being one of the most important social movements in this country, and it ain't over yet. To me, it has always been our unfinished revolution. And I actually use a personal story. I see the picture of the central bank up there, and I have to say that all my family are bankers. I am the aberration in my family. My uncle Tim O'Grady Walsh is the head of the central bank, in fact, and with Ireland's representative in the Paris Club. He's my godfather, my beloved godfather, and my other uncle, a monk taught Brian Cam. So not economics, I'm glad to say, but Irish. So there are contradictions in all of our families and in all of our stories. But what's interesting to me is that that uncle who was in central bank, his grandfather, like my great-grandfather, fought the last eviction with Michael Davitt in West Waterford in the 1800s and was the first elected chairman of Waterford County Council. And I feel that in our DNA as a people in Ireland, and I'll just speak for Irish people now if I may, that there is something in our history as well, in that I felt absolutely outraged when I became involved in a campaign against Merck, Sharp and Dohme in the 1980s, when John Hanrahan's farm was contaminated by toxic pollution by an American multinational. This was prior to water pollution laws, prior to planning laws, no board planola, nothing. It was one of the first multinational drug companies to come here and set up in the Ballydown Valley. But that's where my ancestors survived the famine by growing willow trees and selling baskets from the River Shure. So I do think that we have to look to our own history and our own geography. You know, a million people starved in this fertile land not a long time ago, 150 plus years ago, and a million emigrated. That is our story. And yet today, we have people in the most peripheral place in this country, in Erris, which you kind of only hear about on the weather forecast, let's face it. But you have a community there, a rural community, fighting Shell, Marathon, all the big oil and gas companies, who have literally ramming a pipeline right through their Gaeltacht community. 11 million euro has been spent on Gardaí's. It's the most policed part of the island of Ireland at the moment, for Gardaí to protect them against farmers, like, and people, ordinary people. It is an absolute crime in our country, and a pipeline to be built through two special areas of conservation and to compromise the water for 10,000 people. Now, to my mind, like, it's very important. Well, I'm dying to hear Oscar speaking, because for me, Bolivia is a huge shining example. And we know that the documents, as Seamus Heaney says, the documents of civilization have been written in our blood and tears. And we know what it has meant to people in Bolivia and in these countries to fight these fights, and for Eyad in Palestine. And our heart bleeds for them, but our tears are all the same. And I just remember the words of Enrique when I came back from Nicaragua. I met Enrique, who was the only survivor of a Contra landmine attack in the northern region of Matagalpa. And he said to me, you know, Clara, there is a limit to what you can do in another person's revolution. And I was kind of taken aback, saying, well, you don't want me to go back to Nicaragua, which is all I want to do. And he said, sometimes you can do an awful lot by fighting for change in your own country. and that in itself is an important lesson in solidarity. So I think, to be honest with you, that coalition building is hugely important. The solidarity we have with these people, and the Blue Movement is absolutely, its time has come. But we have to go back into the ordinary communities in Ireland as well, who are fighting to save our land. You know, who are trying to stop toxic pollution, incinerators, dumps and landfills, and even if they're NIMBYs, and even if they're PDs or whatever, who are, as we bloom, they're dying, I think. So it's just, I feel that our time has come, but I really, really feel for the people in Ireland as well. We need to make these connections back all the time in terms of our coalition building. And I think it was Magellan who said earlier on, solidarity is only possible if we give space for different visions. And that's partly why I mentioned the contradictions, even in my own family, that I don't obviously agree with a lot of my nine uncles and all their things, but at the same time, these are also the people we have to speak to. One of the most successful campaigns this country has ever known was the campaign against the nuclear industry. And it was successful. But it was also, it's very worth studying, and anybody who's studying sociology here will know that that was absolutely across the board, across all political parties and all persuasions. When there was 100,000 people out on the streets for the anti-war movement a few years ago, it was absolutely broad-based. When the people in Killa in East Cork fought Dow Chemicals, who made napalm in the Vietnam War, who still have planning permission to come and set up the drug company there. There was a coalition from everybody, from the IRA to the ICA and the IFA, and everybody was against it. The housewife of the year that year, she was out against that factory coming. If coalition building, I would put this as a question to you. Can you live with it that it might not be people who've got a PhD in being against neoliberal economics? I mean, that might be what we feel underlies it all, but I think that we need to build coalitions with people who disagree with us at other levels as well, if we actually really want to save the earth. Because peak oil and climate change are actually an opportunity for us to make these changes back towards self-reliance, back towards the simplicity and the simple living. And that was one other thing that I just thought in terms of education. I don't know who it was said it, but I think it was Njoki, who said that, and I think this is a tragedy, that the people who are educated think that they have to leave the land. And we're losing our connection with the land, which is actually our connection with surviving. And 60% of the ecosystems of the planet are actually being destroyed as we speak. They're on the verge of collapse. So I think we really do have to learn what is our education for if we're not teaching the kids how to save seeds and how to grow their own food and how to work manually again. That's what we need, I think.
Well, when I was looking at this question about what does movement building mean to you, the issue that came up for me was that, you know, being experienced within the international debt movement, where there was a debate between southern debt groups and northern debt groups about, you know, how you actually bring about change. And one of the critiques that the southern debt groups made, particularly the more radical groups, made about was that they said, well, in the north you take more of a campaign approach. You take, you know, it's more time-limited campaigns. You have narrow, more specific demands that don't necessarily challenge the current system. There's some limited mobilisations, and that all leads to a more PR, celebrity kind of driven approach. Whereas they were saying in the South that there was more of a social movement approach, where it would be about defining your demands in a way that challenges the system. And I think one of the banners around here talks about debt being illegitimate, which is would be very much, you know, the demand that came out of the southern group, saying we have to not just say debt is a problem for human development, which it is, but it also is illegitimate, so that it's not just it can't be paid, but it shouldn't be paid. Now, obviously, that's quite that's quite a simplistic sort of division to say the north is this and the south is that. And it's just a device to kind of try and draw out the differences. And the people who wrote about this actually said this, that we're not saying that there's no social movements in the north, etc. But what it meant, when I was thinking about that particular debate in relation to today, two kind of examples came up in my mind about recent mobilisations here. One was the Make Poverty History mobilisation back in 2005, where, as I said earlier, was reminding people that, like, there was, I don't know, 20,000 people came out on the big rally. And I think soon after that, my memory was that there was also the Irish Ferries dispute, and the trade unions here mobilised, and they got, I don't know, 50, 60, I don't know many, tens of thousands out. So both great days. But when I went along to the Irish Ferries, the trade union one, and I compared it to the Make Poverty History one, there's a number of things that struck me. One was the Make Poverty History took months, the mobilisation took months to organise. They, you know, the whole razzmatazz about, you know, getting bands there, getting musicians and celebrities, and Bono was giving people texts from at his event in the Croke Park to all come on the event. Nothing wrong with any of that, but when I went to the trade union one, I looked around, all they had was a big stage and a sound system. They'd organised it in a week, and their speakers were David Begg, Jack O'Connor. They were the leaders of the trade union movement. There was no razzmatazz, there was no celebrities. And what it struck me in looking at was, I thought, God, the trade union machine is in good order still. I thought it had rotted and rusted and, you know, disintegrated over the years of partnership. It really said to me, there is a machine there that can actually mobilise people. And I think movement building is important to get to a point where we're not as dependent as we have been in, you know, the Bonos and the Bob Geldofs and the celebrities, etc., etc. So I see movement building as more getting into more autonomous campaigning activity. I also see it as contesting more in the public arena through mobilisations, through public awareness, etc. Whereas I think a lot of our small injustice campaigns over recent years, I won't say all, but a lot have done a lot of like behind door lobbying, engaging with decision makers. And I think there's an interesting debate, and people who will have different opinions on it, like about that. And I read a very interesting quote from somebody from the organising committee of the Brazilian Landless Movement, where he was asked, you know, about negotiations and what was their position on it. And he said, we're not against negotiations per se, but negotiations must be the fruit of people's struggle. And that has struck with me as a really good way of putting it, so that maybe in some ways in some of our campaigning, the getting in on, whether, you know, bums on seats and in behind closed doors with the power brokers has actually become, you know, that has become the campaign, that has become the mobilisation. So I would see movement building as shifting the balance. And because I would agree with the man that, you know, there's nothing wrong with negotiations so long as you're doing it from a position of power. I'm going to say something else a bit maybe controversial here. I also would see movement building as enabling more people-to-people contacts. I'm not a great believer in the internet and, you know, it can all happen through the internet. I'd say I'm probably a minority of one here about that. But I actually think building trust and building, and that kind of energy, I've heard quite a few people today, in fact I've got a lot of energy from being at this event, and motivation to go a step further. And certainly my own political history would be, because I was so motivated by being in the women's liberation movement, I then could see very easily that I also needed to, I'm living in Britain, so I need to do something about my neighbours from, you know, Africa, from the Caribbean, from the Indian subcontinent, who were actually being discriminated against as well. It wasn't just me as a woman. So I just think, how do we make sure that the movement building actually encompasses that energy that we get out of engaging with each other? So.
I think one of the core issues around the whole topic of movement building is to attempt a development of some sort of common goals, to attempt to begin a process of articulating some sort of common view of the type of world that we would like to live in, and from that maybe the development of some common strategies and tactics that we can unite across. I think a lot of campaigns, by their very nature, start out from the point of view of being against something, against an injustice or against a proposed further injustice. And somebody referred earlier on to uniting the no's. I think if we could take that a step further and take a process of starting to think, what's the yes? what's the ideal world we actually would all like to live in if we were campaigning for something instead of campaigning against? There's a poster over there that says another world is possible. What is the type of world that we'd like to live in? And can we start that process of discussing not we're united by what we're against, but are we united for something? Are we united working towards something? What do we mean by the slogan for global justice? What's people's definition of global justice? And can we start a process by which we can discuss with each other what's meant by global justice and what that very term means? And that, I think, if we can start that process of discussing what type of world we like to live in, and can we, because my version of that is that we seriously do need to start to talk about a type of building a world in which we can live, which gets rid completely of the divide between rich and poor. Not which reforms it, not which changes it for the better, but which gets rid of it completely. We're not talking about making the World Bank or the IMF better in some way. We're talking about trying to build a world that actually gets rid of those institutions and gets rid of that divide between rich and poor. I think we need to try and start also teasing out how can we get to a world that gets rid completely of the division between leaders and led. The division between rulers and ruled. That some people's role in the world supposedly is to be ruled by others. Some people, supposedly, their role is to rule the rest of us. Can we start a process of discussing how to get rid of that? It's not an easy task to do, but I think if we actually start thinking about where we want to get to, it's not about reforming these institutions. It's not about reforming the system, but it's actually about trying to build a new system and a new world. I think it was in a joke this morning that referred to holding governments accountable. And yes, governments should be held accountable. But also, we need urgently, I believe, to start a process of discussing how we can build a world in which governments and the need for governments will be abolished, and that we can actually start to rule from below in some sort of a real sense where people can have ownership of the world's resources, and that the waste and the utter waste of the current capitalist system is done away with. That's the challenge, I think, in terms of movement building. Not that we all have to agree on all of that right now, but we have to find a process by which, number one, we ourselves can start discussing that among each other in Ireland, among each other in Europe, among each other outside of Europe, and right across the world. And that also, we need to try and build links in terms of the struggles that are currently existing. And where can we draw the common links between all of those struggles and bring people together? And I think I'd love to maybe what Blue might move on from here at a future conference might be held around the title of If Another World Is Possible, What Is That Other World? And I'd love to actually spend a day with this group of people in this room, all of whom I bet have really good ideas of what that world should be and how to get there. And then that's the important process, is to open a space in which we can start discussing that.
Right. I believe that movement building enables us to attain global justice, or makes us achieve our aims where global justice work is concerned. It brings people, like-minded people, together. You know, when we begin to mass ourselves and to begin to move together on specific issues, we begin to effect change in our communities. Just a couple of days ago, I think on Tuesday, we launched a voter registration campaign. Now, when the Africa Centre launched that, it's part of our strategic plan, and we've been doing it consistently for a while now. But for some specific reason, this particular one we did seemed to have caught the eye of so many people, including the politicians, the media houses, and everybody was concerned. So what are you aiming at doing? Is it part of this? Are you guys energized by Obama, or what's going on? You know, and we have to kind of explain to people that no, what we're doing, you know, it has coincided with the good things, you know, happening in the States. Yes, we are encouraged by Obama because he enables us also to see that it is possible for things to happen. But at the end of the day, we want all Africans who live here and all immigrants who live in Ireland to also be able to exercise their franchise here, to be able to speak out. Now, you can speak at the ballot box, and when the political parties realize that there are lots of people, immigrants, who are registered, when they come knocking on our doors and we talk to them, they will listen. You know, I mean, I was talking about the element of fear earlier on. The NCCRI is close to that. If you had about 10, 15 African guys standing in front of the Department of Minister of Integration's office picketing and stuff like that, you can imagine what's going to happen. The guards come around and we might run for our dear lives. You know, because you're not too sure. You call guys to come around, let's go do this. People are like, oh no. Because there's the element of fear is there. But when we get a bigger mobilization, it takes effect. You know, it has a bigger effect. And so we think that when we begin to act together, mobilize ourselves, we can begin to challenge not only governments in the developed world, but also challenge our governments in Africa. We're talking about debt cancellation. We're talking about Millennium Development Goals. What are they doing with all that money that was given to them? Because I was in Ghana last year when Ghana was given $750 million by the United States. Now, I don't have a clue what they did with the money. You see, and the government ordered 1,500 tractors from India. These are Indian tractors for farmers. And then they ordered, the ministers who had farms ordered Massey Ferguson tractors. Now, they knew what was good for them. So why didn't you get the same for the masses? You see, so with these are the kind of things that I believe that we, when we begin to move together, when we begin to mobilize ourselves, we begin to challenge some of the things that are going on there. We begin to challenge some of the ideologies that are beginning to spring up in Africa, where you find a leader of a nation who refuses to give up power, and then the international community decides, okay, then you guys have to have a power sharing agreement. You know, I mean, it's something which has cropped up. It happened in Kenya, now it's happening in Zimbabwe. Where next? You see, the issue here is this. If it's time for you to go, come on, get out and walk out of the place. That's as simple as that. You know, and I think that when we begin to mobilize ourselves like that, I'm sure that we'll begin to get even the governments in Europe and the governments in Africa to understand that the world has changed, the times have changed, and when people speak, there is power in our numbers. Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to throw the discussion open to the floor, I should say again briefly. So I'll ask you to be disciplined, and I'll also ask you to be loud, because remember, you don't have the benefit of these things.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to make a comment that in terms of movement building, I think it's crucial for, you know, organizations like we've seen, you know, over this weekend, pull their resources together, and we talked about vision and things like that. I'm scandalized to look at the room, and we're talking about Africa. You know, Africa is one of the continents we're talking about. But, I mean, in talking about Africans, I don't know how many people are Africans here, but if I could refer to black Africans, you know, I can count how many Africans are here in the room. And I'm really scandalized to see that in talking about Africa, the Africans themselves, to me, look like we're very lackadaisical. You know, we're not concerned about the very issues we're talking about. A lot of Africans are concerned about providing resources to their immediate families, but when it comes to the larger community, you know, the larger African community, a lot of people don't put in efforts. I just wonder why. But you hear from people that Africa's problem is not going to be sorted by the British or by the Americans, it's going to be straightened out by Africans, yet we're not in the forefront of wanting to do, you know, something about the situation. when the Sarawiwa thing, you know, happened some 13 years ago, a lot of, you know, statesmen from abroad spoke out, you know, about the problem and things like that. But then we're not seeing the kind of move we're seeing now. The whole thing then was seen probably in some quarters as a Nigerian thing. But today, it has become, you know, an international thing because everyone is affected by energy, as Claire, you know, rightly said. So I need to understand as an African why we cannot mobilize Africans, why we cannot mobilize the people who wear the shoes and the people that are feeling the pinch. Why can we not mobilize them to take the struggle, us to take ownership of the struggle? I'm looking for an answer to this particular problem, and I hope somebody can help me. Thank you.
Just to say, we're not the only ones who are saying this is our moment. There's an opportunity for us. Also, the IMF are actually also seeing this as their moment. Because across the last decade, fewer and fewer countries were letting themselves into the grip of the IMF. And more and more countries were refusing to take money from the IMF and would pay the higher rate on the market rather than take the concession lending that came from the IMF and the conditions with it. But suddenly, the IMF is refinding for itself a position and a role in the world. It's finding countries so much in need, and part of the EU's package that they decided yesterday would be to increase contributions to the IMF and to bolster the IMF. They also put that as a 100-day, it was part of one of five things, and they're putting it 100 days as when the decision needs to be made. So I would actually suggest that for our campaign, if we're wanting something to collect around in this early stage of bloom, that to follow the leadership of Debt and Development and of the Tobin Tax Campaign, and to put together a number of kind of simple and understandable platforms from their leadership, and to actually collectively make sure that in this 100 days something is heard from civil society around what direction that should happen. Thanks very much.
Really used to stand up to speak, but yeah, I think one of the most important things in terms of movement building is actually remaining and attaining a desire to remain autonomous from authority. And that isn't just about funding, it's about an outward orientation, but also about an inward sense of personal development and collective development. In such ways, I mean, I'd imagine there's a tremendous amount of experience and skills within this room at the minute. And there actually are ways that have been developed within the sort of loose anti-capitalist milieu, for want of a better term, to facilitate large-scale meetings where there's input from everybody. And I think as a movement, we kind of need to look at acquiring the skills that exist already so that we most and best benefit from our kind of knowledge and experience, both politically and our understandings of the different spheres that we work in and stuff like this as well. I think we also need to look at how we build up our own kind of resources. I'm probably just going to plug a project I'm involved in the minute. It's an autonomous social centre called Shumas Free. But I think we kind of need to look at how do we build up the tools that sustain ourselves, as well as sustaining the movement that we're looking to build towards as well. I actually think there is a use, and I'm quite sure as well, to actually have a shared vision of where you want to go. I think it's important to have an analysis of what's going on around the world at the minute. As an example, about 6 months ago I was at a meeting that was about climate change, developing a radical climate change movement in Europe, and specifically in Ireland. There was a representative from a fairly significant global environmental group who talked about climate change, not going to name them, but they refused to talk about capitalism because they said it just wouldn't play with the audience in Ireland. And I think there's an onus amongst those that seek to be representatives and seek to be voices to have the honesty that the same groups and same franchises in the global south and other places around the world will use it as language. So we need to be careful not to get into a media spin about what we do. Remain autonomous, remain confident, build our confidence and build our skills, ensure there's collective discussions on moving forward, and be justfully, but justice is not charity. Justice is, we should be rightfully angry about what's going on. I'll bring that forward.
Just to follow on from what Mark said, I just wanted to highlight sort of two of the tools that we have to help mobilise activists. I think one of them is in the media. I don't know how many people use in the media. Maybe just by a show of hands, the hands of the media. Well, for those that don't, it's indiemedia.ie. I think it's a very good resource for communicating events that are happening and just having some level of dialogue between activists and campaign groups. And that's just on the internet. In terms of practicalities, as Mark said, I'm involved in the Shemeshby as well. It's a social centre in Dublin, and there's more social centres starting up in Ireland. There's one in Galway as well. The idea of a social centre is, well, for us in Dublin, in Shemeshby, it's about giving a direct challenge to the whole sort of capitalist consumer lifestyle that sort of pervades this city and Ireland as well. We sort of offer resources for activist groups and campaign groups. So it's a resource for all of us to use. It's, at the moment, we just got a new building about a month ago, so we're still fixing it up at the moment, but we should be up and running in the next few weeks. And we have a website, shemeshby.org, or you can just Google Social Centre Dublin and you'll find out all the details. There's going to be an article going on the indie media in the next couple of days about Shemeshby, just about what's been happening and the event, kind of events that we've had. And it's also it's another mechanism for activists to become to get together, not on the internet, but face to face, and lots of groups and campaign groups have used Shemeshby in the past. There's been the first climate camp meeting about a couple of weeks ago, so we're going to have a climate camp in Ireland next year. There's also Shell that's been using it across Ireland, and the World Bank protests from last year were organised in Shemeshby, so it's a great resource. It's a free resource for campaign groups and activists to use. It's also about putting on social events and activists being able to have fun and get together. So if they want to know more about it, they can talk to me or Mark at the end. Okay, thanks.
Okay, I've got three more speakers here, and here, and four briefly, and then we'll just stop and go back to our speakers here for final, very quick summing up.
Just a couple of comments. I think that Eritrea's happening to this idea of voluntary and how it informs us and shapes us as we do movement building. I think that it becomes really important to understand what are the things that are going to resonate with people based on their history. So I think this is a really important aspect in terms of where Bloom goes next. There was the issue that Benedict raised about why there are not so many Africans here. And I think that one of the challenges that it is a challenge here, and it was also a challenge that we encountered when we did this work in Washington, D.C., where we were focusing on the World Bank and IMF, and our feeling was that people from the countries where the World Bank and the IMF were doing the most harm should be the ones at the forefront. But for many reasons, people are not. And so one of the questions and some of the questions that we asked were, what are the things that we are doing that exclude people and include people? And it ranged from the times that the meetings were held, it ranged in terms of locations and venues, access, you know, to public transport, etc., etc. And I think these are some very mundane issues, but there's some that we need to answer. And they won't bring, once you've responded to all of those, they won't bring people walking to the meetings, but at least you may be able to catch a few people out there. And Jean, you're not a minority of one, I'm not, please. But it has to do with the fact that at least where I'm working in the communities that I'm trying to reach, if you only use the internet, even for people who have email, you're reaching a very small number of people. So again, this is another example of something that excludes, because if you're expecting people to get information and to respond to email, it's a very small number of people. I know that sometimes I just sort of ignore my email, and I'll go and somebody will have sent me 3 messages because they sent the first one and they expected me to respond immediately, and I didn't. And they're like, did you get my message? And I didn't. And sometimes I do read it and I'm like, this is not an emergency. I mean, I don't really need to respond to this. And by the time I'm responding, they have 5 messages, and maybe they have even started calling to find out what is wrong on my secret. But I'm not on the internet all the time, and no, I've come to discipline myself that I don't need to respond to everything the moment I get it. So we need to think about that. And Claire, you know, what is the housewife of the year, and what do you have to do?
We're going to leave that question till after the formal discussion.
While most of us are busy and ready to point fingers to the IMF and the World Bank, I think the time has come for us to point fingers and to our government. The time has come for us to demand good services from our government. The time has come for us to form campaigns for demanding good service delivery from our government. The time has come for the followers and the leaders to work together towards our freedom. I think we should start being one as the country. In that way, the IMF and the World Bank will have no customers. They will have nowhere to look for. There won't be anyone looking for their citizens. Let's start working together in our countries. And IMF and the World Bank will have no power if we work together as one. If we can do that, the IMF and the World Bank will no longer be a threat to us. We will no longer depend on the IMF and the World Bank because we've been working together in our countries. So let's form ourselves and make ourselves one, working together towards our vision. Followers and leaders, let's become one. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, may I add to what you said to Benita's question? And how we answer Benita's question is through breaking out of what Eric said. I think Eric has said a lot on the problem migrants or Africans are facing. It's food more than what we really see. And that's the number one answer to what Benedita said. And also, when we say that location is not really necessary. Okay, because Benedita was through her patient phone. The location of where we are, this is the city center and it's just crowded. Easiest place to assess. Yes, how many Africans do you see here? Therefore, it is not really, the spirit is not there. The desire is not there. There's no solidarity. And this is what we really need to carry home and really we have to think. If somebody invites me now to a cafe in Saybridge, in a remote part, if I have the spirit, I will go. So, and again, another problem here is fear. Now, what Benedicta said, or what Eric is saying now, some people, getting Eric for Benedicta, they will say, you have to be careful. You have to be careful. Embassies are watching you. There are threats. People send threats in our mobile. Who see you in the street? Say, look, being away from your country doesn't mean that you are safe. So you have to keep that in mind. And you look around, there is no solidarity. That brings that in. When we say broom, we demand that broom, be a broom. You know, it has to grow. It has to be really a solidarity. It has to be very solid. Again, it is also, we will not forget the history of movement, radical movement. We talk of Martin Luther King. But Luther King does it. The whole thing, the spirit of Martin Luther King starts from a woman who resisted the problem in the past. You see, the end of slavery, we do not forget that it is women who put it there. Look at Irish history. Today we see statues of a commonwealth, but before then, there were women. The independence of Nigeria was fought in 1929, it would be 4 months tomorrow, by women's rights. That of Ghana, the same thing. Because the cocoa market, the husband ever selling cocoa, they don't bring some of the women to vote. So the issue is that we have to encourage women to vote. Bro, now, let's hear there is a, this is a local government election or whatever. There are women, especially the migrant women. We have to put them here, support them. Because when there's no finance, but we have to even find a way to support women, especially African women or Latin America or Asia, encourage them, call them, prove, come out. You have to do this. It's not only men, because I believe somewhere that with women involved from, that only when we achieve solidarity and revolution. Thanks a lot.
Mindful of our Stalinist chair, I just wanted briefly to say that to endorse the call which was made earlier for a day to discuss what another world might look like. And there was a wonderful talk by Patrick Kirby this morning in which he said, now is the time to seize the moment and not the time to discuss alternatives. And I would disagree with that slightly because I think there's time to do both. And it's important to exercise imagination, creative imagination, to have discussion, not necessarily to arrive at some sort of common platform, but to think together about what alternatives we might desire, what are viable, and then to think how to act on that imagination.
I think that's like it. Great. Okay. So, just before I go to the speakers for the last formal comments, obviously, this is part of a conversation that's been ongoing, and I want to encourage people really to follow up the conversations here with each other in the sessions that follow over dinner and so on and so forth. So, last comments.
Last comments. I don't want to open. I'll probably open up a whole other discussion by saying that. But I think that the world, you know, when you say about imagine the world, you know, as we'd want it to be, I think that's actually happening as we speak. I mean, there's an energy revolution happening on the planet as we speak, and the reality for us, I think, is that unless we're ahead in our thinking of what we really, really want, and I mean, what Mark is saying there is really interesting to me, and I'd like to discuss it more with him, we're going to be still following the people who have all the access to capital, you know, and we won't actually be able to change the system which oppresses people unless we actually know that. I'm just conscious of the fact that in the last 10 years, in a kind of a recessionary time in Germany, they've created a 250,000 jobs in the alternative energy sector. And that the biggest solar-powered PV plant on the planet that's being built at the moment is being built by the United Arab Emirates, not exactly a well-known democracy. And, you know, the Arabs are already gone off oil. I mean, Shell Solar is, you know, is a huge business. Like, the oil companies are now calling themselves energy companies. So, I suppose I'm kind of talking about energy a lot, but I mean it in relation to debt as well. People are kind of self-centred, even in Ireland, say, at the moment. I think they're so concerned about the economic downturn that to get them imagining the and worried and concerned about the debt in the southern countries is going to be an uphill battle unless we really have our analysis worked out of what it is, this world that we do want, this alternative is, so that we're constantly ahead of the people who, I mean, the dot-com revolution is over. They are now saying it's an energy revolution. I'm just saying this because in 1991, I was saying to Jean earlier that I had my first baptism of fire with a multinational corporation who was brought to meet DuPont in Delaware in the States. We were fighting a huge hazardous waste incinerator in Derry at the time, where they were going to put all of the island of Ireland's hazardous waste. And five of us met with DuPont in their corporate headquarters. And we were fighting in India, Spain, Mexico, North America, and in Ireland. We were fighting DuPont. And DuPont's an interesting company just to take as an example, because they fled France. the time of the Louis was beheaded or something in France, and they went to America. They sold gunpowder to both sides of the American Civil War, and they built it themselves up into a huge chemical corporation. But the five corporate heads that we met in Hotel DuPont on DuPont Avenue, they own the state of Delaware, that day, and these are the guys that Barack Obama is going to be up against, let's face it. They're a huge military and chemical organization. They said that day to us, we will never say that there is something wrong with CFCs until we have cornered the market for the alternative. And that is exactly what happened. Now, at 23 years of age, I actually was really grateful for the lesson, because that's how I think these corporations think. So I'm just saying it because I think that we need to be really clued in about how these corporations work and about what, how much money they have, what their agenda is. I'm really concerned about the academia in Ireland at the moment, the kind of research that's going on into genetics, into the GMO thing, the, you know, the whole thing that's happening globally in relation to our food. I think these are the kind of things that we really, really have to do some very serious research on. And, I mean, I'll say it, I think that Bloom would be a really brilliant organisation to be able to be a holding body for information. Because I'll just say it as an add-on thing. I worked for Greenpeace Ireland, but Greenpeace International shut down 9 or 13 of their smaller offices around the world a number of years ago. And I also learned a lesson in not relying on multinational environmental organizations either. So we have to really understand the way that big business and big corporate lobbying organizations work as well. So that if in each of our countries, if we dig where we stand, then we have a real chance. Just dig where you stand. And if Ahad does it in Palestine, and it's really tough, and if they can do it in Bolivia, but if we do it here and we all link together, that's the only chance I think we have. Thank you.
Well, the two things that struck me listening to the contributions were spaces and ideas. And I really like what people are saying about Chauvin's Spree as Chauvin's Spree, but also as the idea that we create our own spaces from which we can organise. And also I really like the fact that we can have fun and have some of these discussions as well. And even though I am, you know, I sound like a sort of an anti-internet person, I actually think indie media is really important to have an independent radical voice out there. So total support for that. The more thorny issue, I think, is the idea of us having our alternatives. And ever since the fall of communism, I've had this continual criticism, or the left, or the NGOs, or whoever, the social movements, they haven't really come up with alternatives, and this is an actual failure. And I remember at the time of the fall of communism, 1989, going to some of my academic Marxist friends and saying, well, where's the alternative going to come out, or, you know, where's the thinking at? And they looked at me as if I was missing half my marbles, which I think I was, because what I've thought of ever since then, I've thought a lot about it, and I think, where do ideas come from? Where do ideas that are going to, not just ideas in the abstract, but ideas that are actually going to take root and develop? How come Marx sat in the British Library in 1870 to 1875, or whenever it was, and came out of Das Kapital and all that happened through that? So, I think there is a real challenge there about alternatives. It's not that we don't have ideas, but it's ideas that will actually match the moment and actually take root. And I agree with everybody, the whole thing about seizing the moment, and I think the difference is what does that mean? And we may have to continue with an approach that either, I know Colin made an approach as proposed, and I don't know the woman's over there's name also said, you know, we make demands of our governments, and Colin talked about coming out with some demands around the IMF. But as we're doing that, we don't say that we are making these demands in order to, you know, get quick fix results, but that this is part of us actually developing our ideas. And I think we really need an interaction between the action and reflecting and the ideas, and I think we have to get moving fast. Because one of the things that Pavel said this morning, he said the fight back has started. And when I hear the words fight back, I always think it's us, we fight back. But Pavel actually meant global capital is fighting back. And I thought, we all thought, you know, I don't know how many people read the article in the Irish Times yesterday from Thurlough O'Sullivan from IBEC, where he He was looking at the current situation and he said, all the wealth of Ireland is made by the private sector. The public sector is a burden. When we're looking for a solution to the current crisis, which he took no responsibility for in terms of members of his organisation or his sector. So I thought that was a strong ideological fight back to try and position where the crisis is and who is going to have to pay for the crisis. So I would see us as, and I think what Bloom can do, because it's kind of diverse and it's got different bodies in it and different movements in it, it can actually do the thing of developing more spaces where we can actually, there are our spaces and we can actually develop our sort of cultural and fun and also strategy and our ideas. But I think I see it as action and ideas somehow or another developing in some kind of interaction, a dialectic, a new dialectic.
Just a joke, actually, it just came to my mind while I was listening to the conversation here. Brian Lennon had finished his budget speech by calling for patriotic action from us all. And his version of patriotic action was that we should basically take money from our health service, from our education service, from service and from overseas development aid, etc., and give it to the bankers. Right? That's his version of patriotic action, that we suffer in order that the rich get looked after. I don't know if anybody noticed the other version, the other reference to patriotism this week, which was even more cynical. The Lord Mayor of Dublin is going to switch on the Christmas lights tomorrow, 3 weeks early, and called us on us all in a gesture of civic patriotism to come spend our money in Dublin city centre. Because the poor shopkeepers are very poor. Now, that's cynical politics. Compare that to the level of energy in this room today. That's what we need to tap into. The level of energy each one of us has to give up a day to come along to discuss ideas and discuss issues. And when I say about starting a discussion about the type of world we live in, every single one of us doesn't need to actually start. We've been having it. It's ongoing. And we need to continue that process of building a new type of politics and a new type of patriotism, if you want to call it that, if they want to be cynical and use that word, that our link is workers and unemployed in Ireland have much, much more in common with workers and unemployed and poor people right across the world than we do with Tony O'Reilly or Michael Smurfit or, sorry, Jean, your uncle is the head of the Central Bank or whatever. That's where the connection is. Our connection is that we do actually have far more in common than divides us. And we have a great forum to continue discussion about what type of world we do want to live in. And I think that the point that was made was really important, that the IMF ain't sitting back and ain't taking it, lying down. They are seeing opportunities. People are moving in, big businesses moving in this opportunity to look at new ways of screwing us, basically. And so it's really important that we take on board Subcommittee Marcos's edict, as he said, to be as apatistic in your own country. Where we fight on issues that directly affect ourselves, we actually that has a resonance everywhere. So as well as solidarity campaigns with issues outside of Ireland, I think it's really important that we get stuck in on the issues that are taking place right here. So whether that's education cuts, whether it's Shell to Sea, whether it's whatever other campaign is happening in your area, there's loads of stuff going on. People getting stuck in and winning victories or fighting for victories in your own community and in your own area and in your own workplace, that gives that strength to the movement to move it forward on a global basis.
Right. In concluding, I just want to tell you a little kind of story that I encountered 2 years ago. I was in Ghana and my children asked me to bring cocoa pods. The cocoa pod. So I brought some ripe ones and then I went to be a school. So I went into both classes, and in my son's class at the time, they were all 7 years old. And so I opened it and they wanted to see the seeds and they wanted to taste it and all that kind of stuff. So then I told them about how they got the chocolate and how it's processed and everything. And one boy asked me, so how much does a big bag of the cocoa seed cost? I said, well, I'm not sure, because it's decided in the developing world, in Europe or somewhere in Europe. And he's like, how? And I'm like, well, that's how it is. Mm-hmm. He said, and he said, if I produce it, nobody tells me how I sell it. You know, and this was a 7-year-old boy, and you know, it took me aback. You know, I was really shocked. But the idea here is this: we're talking about blue, and we're saying that it's people acting together for radical change. Now, to achieve radical change, you've got to be radical. You see, you've got to be radical, and we need, in order to be able to challenge the world order, we need to be radical. We've just had Claire mention the effect of the multinational corporations. In all the things we're going to be doing, there is a price to pay. And I'll leave you all with this question. Are you prepared to pay the price? Thank you.
You've been listening to a meeting of the Bloom Movement, which defines itself as people in Ireland taking action together for global justice. This podcast was recorded by the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You can find more podcasts from us at www.wsm.ie.